Welcome to Changes. It's Annie McManus here with a really special episode for you. My guest this week is Goldie. He is first and foremost a music DJ and producer, but he's also a really successful graffiti artist and actor. Instantly recognizable for his shaved head and his gold grills, he has permeated so many different layers of culture at this point, from nightclubs to TV reality shows to movies, dating everyone from Bjork to Naomi Campbell. He's kind of an institution in his own right. Goldie started out as a graffiti artist, living for a spell in America before coming back to London in the early 90s and discovering jungle and drum and bass music. It was one night where he finally got into the nightclub rage in London for the first time after trying for a few months that everything changed for him.
It made me feel fucking amazing. It just made me feel I have to do this. I want to be that. You know, hearing this music and seeing, you know, the silhouette of a DJ playing it, the mystery of Fabian Grubeider, all of this amazing sound.
Well, it's safe to say that Goldie did it. He not only immersed himself in the sound and the culture around drum and bass, but he elevated it massively. In 1994, he launched the now legendary music label Metalheads with the DJ duo Chemistry and Storm, Kemi being his girlfriend at the time, who then later tragically died in a car accident. In 1995, his album Timeless went to number 7 in the UK charts, selling 250,000 copies and revolutionising drum and bass music. For me as a 17-year-old girl in Dublin, Timeless was a completely alien sound. I had genuinely never heard anything like it. It was so enticing and mysterious and thrilling. And it kind of represented a whole other world. It made me curious for what was out there beyond suburban South Dublin. It kind of contributed to me wanting to discover England. Goldie was born Clifford Joseph Price in Walsall in 1965. His mother was Scottish, his father Jamaican. He was raised in children's homes in the West Midlands and by foster families since the age of 4, where he was physically and sexually abused. Something which he discusses in this episode, so please be aware if this could be triggering for you. He now lives in Thailand with his wife and his youngest daughter. I think he has 5 children in total. He loves to go trekking in the jungle. He is mad about yoga and still completely immersed in music and culture, as you will hear. Such an honour to have this time with Goldie. Welcome to Changes. Goldie, this conversation is all about change, but can I start by asking why you decided to call yourself or how you got the name Goldie?
Well, when hip-hop came, the culture of hip-hop, for me, was seeing the culture of hip-hop. I saw these videos, and we used to sample videos from Gladys Knight and the Pips or Malcolm McLaren, and we'd see Rocksteady Crew, and we'd see graffiti in the background, and I was always fascinated with, you know, the culture of it. I gravitated more towards the art because I loved art. And graffiti was the thing. Before that, my whole family, when I kind of left the care system and went to Wolverhampton, my brother and all of my kind of stepbrothers all had dreads. And I kind of had to follow suit. So, you know, you kind of getting beeswax and waxing your hair and, you know, wearing caps and stuff. And I realised very, you know, after a couple of years, I couldn't spin on my head with dreadlocks because they didn't wear that well. So I ended up cutting my hair. And having one lock, it was
wow.
Because it was Goldie Locks, and then it just ended up being Goldie One Lock, and then it was just Goldie.
I always thought it was from the grills.
No, it wasn't at all. That came later, much later. It was because we were in a crew called West Side Crew, and we all had our name on our Adidas green tracksuit. Mine was Goldie Locks, and then I just ended up not having the locks there anymore. Just became Goldie. Yeah. And then, everyone's like, and I kind of started getting the gold after that.
Yeah. Well, let's get straight into the first question, which is about your childhood change. You mentioned being in the care system. You mentioned your family. You've had just a mad, like, first half of your life. so colourful, so highs, lows, all of it. But do you mind bringing us through the biggest change that you went through as a child that you think?
Well, the biggest change really was, I guess, music was always my solace because I think I went through a lot of abuse being young in the care system, which is unfortunate. But, you know, the older I got, the more I realised I was not the only one. Do you know what I mean? You almost feel like I'm the only one, and you start playing this really small violin. Yes, all this stuff happened. But that was the biggest change, because it really upset my natural path of growing up as a child. It's only disturbing when you look back on it, really, and it starts to affect your adult life, so to speak, like getting a girlfriend and being normal, or which is kind of why we share a very strong interest that I think Gabor Maté has been an amazing, in modern times, along with Sam Harris, who's another great, great mind of modern times. That really helped me a lot, especially on the back of what I'd gone through and understanding that I wasn't to blame for a lot of the trauma. But you see, that it pushed me into this thing of music, where the music became something different. I always loved music. All kids love music. I don't care what it is. But I think being in the care system and being in the homes in particular, when I was moved around, I found music was the place I'd run to, and I'd lock myself away listening to music. But we'd have like half an hour on the stereo every weekend when all the kids went back to their kind of broken families or whatever they went back to. And there was a certain amount of kids left inside the home. So it was kind of almost like a skeleton crew of people that were working at the children's home. And we'd have a stereo every week to play music for half an hour. And I'd go to a record shop called Ruby Reds in Wolverhampton, where I used to roller skate, because skating was my passion. I used to live on skate. For about 5 years, I lived on quads. That was my thing.
Yeah.
And I'd finally had the balls to run away from this children's home, because everyone ran. Everyone, there was always runners.
That was just a pattern. People just
it
did
was
that.
A thing, like, you know, they've run. And we'd be counting the days of how long it's going to take them to get caught. And you see the police car turn up and all the kids run to the windows, and then the kid walks out the car and walks down the driveway, and it gets straight into the office. We have to exit the hallway into the playroom, and then you see them have this walk of shame back to their room, which they were banished for a couple of weeks. And then as soon as they integrated, it was like, what was it like?
What did you see?
You know, and it became this thing, and I never got round to doing it. And then I finally did run. But of course, I just ran back to my skating rink. It wasn't going to be very hard to find me. So I'd found a really mixed bag of music. And the main song for me was Logical Song. That Supertramp, that changed my life, that song. Because lyrically, it was...
What are the lyrics?
When I was young, when life was so wonderful, so beautiful, what would you say if you was calling me a radical? You know, it was the idea of this speaking to your soul. You know, it's about me, this record is. And I guess that's what that's what a great record is, isn't it? A great song is something that touches you in such a way. And it was this idea of freedom that the song had gave me. And it was conscious.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle. Oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds.
It's interesting, that first line, when I was young, when life was so beautiful. Like, as a child, did you find beauty in life? Was there parts of it that you found beauty in?
Well, it was, because I'd always been an oddity, and I'd been at odds with myself. So in my normal everyday life, it was fucking miserable. I had a miserable time growing up.
So you were in care from 4 years old?
From 4 years old
until I was 17, pretty much. Yeah.
So I'd moved I was in four homes, three foster homes that didn't work. And the abuse started when I was in, I can't name them, but I was there, and the sister was adopted and I was fostered. And she started on me when I was about, I think it was about seven, she started on me. She was about 17, 18, and it just became really abusive. And it was kind of like, don't say anything or you're going to go back to the home. And that was, I was terrified. And of course it got more and more, and it became this thing where the rejection, you know, this, I'm like, why is this person coming to me just at nighttime when everyone's asleep?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And I'd have to go into their room, and it was sneaking around. It was horrible. It was a horrible experience.
And the parents had no idea what was going on.
No, well, they were, you know, a religious family. I don't know, whatever they were. And it just became this horrible thing. And to be honest, I loved music though, and I'd got into music, and it was the one thing I had that was good. But yeah, it was good. Pretty miserable. I also felt that when I was in the home and started talking to other kids, that they'd all been through a lot of stuff. I was always to be the joker in the class, hiding, like the Smokey Robinson, Tears of a Clown. I became that.
Were you shy? Like, and in the homes as well, were you a shy person? Did you kind of stay in the shadows, or were you like, right in the shadows, middle of things?
But I was bullied a lot, so I became the kind of, if you're going to join the gang, you've got to let us give you a kick in at the end of the night.
Right.
To GBH, police oppression. Yeah. You know, you've got to be part of the gang, you know, you've got to take a smack in the face. Yeah. You know, take the piss out of him. So you kind of found your place in this kind of little punky gang I found. And then you just get beat the fuck up, or you ended up being the guy who everyone turns on at the end of the night when I've had a few beers.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it got a bit crazy for me, and then just still kind of finding my feet. But then you find your clan. You don't find your place in it.
Mm.
I used to always have to be the kid that went home early, because obviously you've got to get back to a certain curfew.
Right.
But then you had a sense of community inside the home. And there were some good moments, like, my waypoint, I have waypoints. I have this idea of...
What's a waypoint?
Like a waypoint, like a ship has a waypoint. Like this,
okay,
way,
got you.
This ship's going in one direction and it hits a waypoint, and that changes the direction of this person's life. And okay. For me, like, you know, I know every word to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because that album, it was an 8-track going to Derbyshire camping with the kids. And it was the best holiday ever. Camping, and this really Freudian sense of beans being cooked on a stove outside with bacon, and being cold, you know, just outside of a sleeping bag, but warm inside, and going out and walking across the sand dunes, and, you know, making your way through Derbyshire, you know, then to Wales, and then coming back to Bakewell, and all of these amazing places. There was this mixed bag of kids that were all from different backgrounds. So my musical background became Steel Pulse, UB40. You know, it's Cat Stevens, you know, the Supremes, you know, Miles Davis. All of this music came to me over the years. But it was so multicultural, my music background.
Of course, yeah.
I used to work at a Saturday morning garage in Wollenhall. You know, when the boss was away, we were making these fake guitars with plywood and welding rods, because it was a garage. And after the boss went out, we'd turn up the stereo on the radio, you know, this kind of cassette player, and we'd play Rattus Norvikus from beginning to end. You know, so I was a little bit of a punk, a little bit of an upstart. Finding out Bob Marley was mixed race blew my mind.
Oh,
it
wow.
blew my mind. I was thinking, he's not black, he's actually mixed race. And that blew my mind, because I thought, he's like me. But it was weird. There's these weird thoughts of, I remember my father taking me from my mother's house. He kidnapped me and took me to London.
What age would you have been? Sorry.
I would have been about 4 or 5. I've been about 4 at this point. It was the kind of reason why I'd gone back in care, because I was with my mum. She was doing different things. It wasn't working out. I was left alone for a long period of time. My dad had found me somewhere and took me. And I always remember sitting in the car with the kind of one bench seat as opposed to separate seats, which was weird. And it's these memories come flooding in of him on the motorway and taking his hands off the wheel and clapping his hands, and we listened to music on the radio. And I was thinking, he's driving no-handed. It was just freaking me out as a kid.
Yeah.
But these thoughts and memories of all this music coming in to my cortex, this weird and wonderful stuff, there are these musical moments that directed my life. And, you know, being put into a room while I was being processed and finding Logical Song on a gramophone, at which I pull the arm down and kept playing over and over again, crying my eyes up. And then the matron's coming in, and my social worker, who I really liked at the time, Miss O'Connor, she was my kind of pillar of strength, of like, she felt normal to me. But in this strange place, and being dragged out of this room and being taken to my room, which really freaked me out. But then moving to Hammerwich, where I'd heard John Holt for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, all these weird and wonderful songs that kind of galvanised my mind. And one in particular that really stood out was Judy Zook's Stay With Me Till Dawn. The back end quartet string arrangement on Judy Zook, I think, was really responsible for me getting into chord arrangement with Timeless even.
Wow. I wonder what it is about the human mind that in those first kind of formative years from like 0 to 10... those memories kind of dictate the rest of your life. Like, you're so much more sponge-like. I suppose there's less in there, so everything that comes in is more powerful to impact you. It feels like music, you know, as you say, that's such a lovely way of putting it, those waypoints. It's kind of like, it's like your compass. It kind of helped you through.
It's, in studying, you talked about the brain and how those formative years, yes, they do shape the entire life. And I think that when I look at the work of Gabor Mate and really go into that, it is so true, because you think, these records, it impacted me, and I wanted to, I never thought I was ever going to make music. That was something that was so far beyond me, even though I had this such passion and love for music. It was only until, like, I never made my first song until I was 27.
But you made art. And I suppose that's the thing, like, thinking about you, reading your story of your life. You're a true innovator. You know, this podcast is about change. You're an artist in that whatever medium you pick up, whether it's a spray can, whether it's a, you know, an 808, whether, you know, whether it's a piece of clay that you sculpt, you're coming at it from a place where you are creating something and changing that, you know, changing something. I don't know. It's really hard to describe, but.
Well, it's alchemy.
It's alchemy. It's alchemy. That's what I want to talk about. Alchemy. Yes.
Well, it's alchemy. I've always had the idea, because I got involved in the arts and understood, I know it sounds really weird to people that might not know this. You know, this thing that people call graffito, which is from Latin, graffito, the idea of putting your mark on society.
Yeah.
Dogs have always pissed on lampposts, territorial, leaving your markings. You know, this isn't new. The Greek philosophy and the idea of leaving your mark. The media just changed. The medium that we use has just changed. That's all.
Yeah.
And I'd learnt from these early ideas of getting into goldsmithing, and I always thought to myself, I was fascinated with melting gold. And
I have it here. I have the what you've written about it in your book, and I found this bit so powerful. It says, what you're talking about, melting gold to make grills. And you said, knowing I could change the structure of something precious that was seemingly so solid and unchangeable led me to believe that I might also have the power to melt some of the hardened feelings inside myself, which had fused and melded together in the crucible of the darker times of my childhood, and maybe reshape them into something more positive. The awareness stirred inside me that I had the power to shape the world around me for the better. Boom.
I know. Boom. I don't know. These things, I can't remember that, but yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yes.
It makes so much sense, I think, when you read that. The idea of being able to break something down and build it up into something different, you know?
Well, I felt that with the music is that my approach, you know, we'd had this great jungle and drum and bass has been, again, the underdog of the country and the world for such a long time. The bottom rut of the electronic ladder, it was.
Yeah.
Has always seemed to. I'd worked the alchemy inside of the culture. And then thought, well, my contribution to that would be to understand that I can take roughage, all of these top line bits and pieces of songs that I like Japan, a bit of David Sylvian, and embrace that within this structure of music. And of course, that's why the label was created. Metalheads is an idea that the skull, music will be here long after we've gone. The headphones, music will be here long after we're gone. You know, we'll live and die within the music.
Yeah.
And also wanting to create a platform for artists to be able to do what they want to do within their own alchemy. So that's always been a very important thing for me. And of course, it took a long time to catch up. There's always this thing that people looked at drum and bass as this disposable kiddie music. But yet, I always felt it was the uncle under the stairs that no one wants to invite to the barbecue because he's going to tell the kids what it's like. Don't bring Uncle Goldie. No. Don't bring Uncle Shy FX because he's going to just tell everyone. You know what I mean? No. Don't bring Dillinger. No. We don't want Dillinger. We want something softer. You know, and it was this thing that we were doing this stuff that we loved with a passion, and we wanted an environment to play it in.
You were doing it always from the start, doing it differently. And you listen back to your albums now and... Fucking hell, man. They're so raw. Like, listening to them in the context of reading your books and understanding your life and then listening to the albums, you put so much more into them. You put pain into them. You know, you have these big, huge, ambitious, you know, orchestral arrangements, you know, so much more than what Jungle was, I think, at the time. I don't want to speak for the whole of Jungle, but it felt anyway that you brought a different slant to it.
We're telling a story. And this is our story. You know, mother is not an easy feat.
It's not an easy feat.
I don't expect anyone out there to be a fan of it.
You needed to make that record. You needed to make it. We should specify for the listeners that Mother is how long as a track?
Mother's 1 hour long.
One hour long. Yeah.
Well, the whole point of that record was to deal with pure alchemy, the universe, conception, all of that stuff.
Goldie, can we talk about the 90s? 94, Metalheads was started. 95, Timeless came out. 96, You're Going Out with Bjork. 98, Saturn Returns with Mother on it. That was a fucking busy decade for you.
Me and Scotty call them the golden years. It is the perfect Polaroid.
I mean, you were really, really famous. I mean, you still are, but like in the 90s, it must have been a very peak.
Well, the 90s was crazy because, you know, the whole Bjork thing was crazy. Yeah, the paparazzi were outside the house every day and all this madness and craziness. But remember, you've got to put it into context, man. When Timeless won the award for the Mobos, when the Mobos award looked like it was something that was given away at a fucking, at a bingo sale, yeah? It was like something you'd got an award when you'd run a race when you were five at the local primary school, right? And you got Tumo's Best Dance Album... Right, Best Jungle Act, when there's only a few anyway. But you're up against George Michael, Destiny's Child, Jamiroquai, Timeless. It's so weird.
It's so weird.
At that point. But I think that's what was great about it, being so far ahead. But you see, it was the catalyst. Every person took the checkbook out for this music. You know, anyone that was on the label.
So it got passed down, so a lot of other people won from Timeless winning.
Groove Rider always puts it like this. He always says, you put a lot of food on a lot of tables for a lot of people.
There's a story, actually, that he says, is it him or is it Fabio, saying that there was a wedding, and they don't specify whose wedding, but there was a wedding.
Oh, no, it wasn't. I could say
it. And it was a car park full of the most incredible cars, and they were like, whoa, we're doing, drum and bass is doing good. Jungle's doing good.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a time when we were all driving Ferraris and being natters and being crazy. I remember that time.
Goldie, can we go back to like the man behind the music for a bit? So the 90s we know was bonkers on a professional level, like just so successful on a creative level, so inspiring. But what about on a personal level?
Well, on a personal level, I think I did more drugs than Al Pacino. I think definitely I think I'd opened a Pandora's box. I mean, my addiction came through, you know, this want of something I couldn't have.
When did you know?
When you're sitting in the fucking, you know, sitting out at 6 a.m, no drug dealers answering their phone, you know, calling around on your hands and knees trying to find drugs or whatever you've hid them in. Do you know what I mean? And I've realised it was too much for me. It was just way too much. And
was it every weekend? Like,
oh, every night. I remember the peak of my addiction. I think I was doing like 3-4 Rohypnol a night with a litre bottle of vodka. And 3 Rohypnol, 4 Rohypnol to try and get back to sleep.
To knock out, right.
Oh, yeah, to knock out. Yeah, and an eighth of gear. Do you know what I mean? Oh, trust me, I'd done everything. And then I just got so sick of it all because it's just something that you can't satisfy. Mm. And I think that's because there's a lot of stuff, there's a lot of unanswered stuff. And it's only until Saturn's Return. Saturn's Return got crucified by the media.
So that was the album that had Mother on it, which is the opening track, which is an hour long.
It is my black opera. It is my, my thing. I think that album took a lot of effect, but I knew the minute I stepped out of the closet with that record, you know, to say that I'm an addict and to say that I'm all of these things, but this is prolific. You know, that album had KRS-One, Noel Gallagher, David Bowie. You know, it was a big...
Did it get the reception you wanted?
No, he didn't, but I knew he wouldn't until many years later. He won some crazy awards in Paris, you know, like 4 years ago. People recognised that it was re-released. But the thing is, it's like, you have to understand, man, I'm pre-internet. It doesn't bother me. Did certain albums that you realised that were released by the greats probably didn't get the same?
That's, in my opinion, true artistry, is this kind of fearlessness and this kind of real commitment to self-expression regardless of other people's opinions. You have to express this pure emotion, pain, whatever it is you were going through. You had to put that into that record. It had to exist at that time. That's the point of making art.
It's my job to upset the apple cart. It's my job to make that vibration in the water that you might not be able to see those patterns in that water yet.
Yeah.
I've grown up in this music, so I get to do what the fuck I want and say what I want.
I wanted to ask about, you know, the idea of tribes and music giving you tribes, graffiti you tribes, hip hop culture giving you tribes, but also coming from children's homes where they, as you say, you are always around a group of people. Do you feel like your kind of path in life has led you to always be part of these kind of chosen families?
Yeah, that's a very Freudian one. Yeah,
sorry,
I mean,
that's my terrible at COD psychology.
No, but it's, I like it. No, it's good psychology. Mm. And, you know, and powerful she's becoming. I believe strongly that no man is an island. And trust me, I've been lonely in addiction where no one understands it and gets it. Going down the rabbit hole and being, you know, through there and then finding better healers, whether it's ayahuasca or different things that kind of bring you to the mother and bring you to this place of understanding. That's the difference. But tribes have always been in my life. They've always been like New York and finding a group of people that have got broken families. Oh, I'm not the only one? Great. And I'm thinking, yeah. My mum was this and mum was... Well, their mum's all the same. Oh, actually, my dad's on crack. Really? Yeah, yeah. You got caught. You got arrested for doing angel dust. Yeah, and we're out here on the street and we're painting trains. It's like, wow, I thought I had it rough. You know what I mean? So I've always done that. And I think reinforced, you know, going there and seeing these guys. And I'm saying, guys, the clubs are playing the music. Ah, fuck it, G, I don't really want to go out. Well, I'll go out for you. Give me the roots, give me the dope. Like, I'll go. I've created that pathway. I've always had this thing about creating tribes. The label was a tribe, a melting pot of ideas, I like to call it. You know, just have all of this wonderful music together and share the sound. And Metalheads has this sound. And it's probably the only one left that stayed intact. And it's, you know, never kind of been a major player, really, in terms of selling to a major. But tribalism is the key.
You're finding your own identity within it, right? It's a way to help shape yourself in the world. Now, I'm just thinking of you, young you, listening to Bob Marley for the first time, finding out he's mixed race. It's kind of that, isn't it? It's like there's people out there like me. There's people out there.
The thing you said about tribalism, it's been a very strong point of it. And I think D&B became its own tribe because for so long, D&B was so... Isn't it mad when you listen to D&B now, it's what we were doing 25 years ago. With a nice little sample on the top of it. It's for any, because we were so far ahead of it.
Yeah.
But it's the passion of the music that people love. It's the energy that D&B gives people. It's like you can't beat British passion for this music. I remember my daughter playing me something, going, Dad, I'm at a rave. And they're playing this tune, and it was a rip-off of Pendulum. And I'm like, let me play you the original. It's like...
And it's like, I love that Goldie's your dad. No, yeah, you need to hear the original.
Yeah. And it's great because, I mean, it's not like they're coming in on the back of, Dad, listen to this. I went out and went to this party and there's this Diana Ross tune. You know, we're playing it. They're going out. This is a D&B.
Yeah, that's great. So the starting point.
Their starting point, man. There's a girl from Game of Thrones out raving at, you know, at Fabric.
Oh, yeah, Maisie.
Maisie's out there loving it. Everyone loves this music. People recognise what we've done and they're finally going, you know, Metalheads has been this thought war thing. And you always say, go back to you, but this is me.
I want to talk about the adult change. And you talked about that point in the 90s where you realised that the addiction was consuming your life and it was taking too much of you. How did you change? Like, look at you now. You are the picture of health. You are
you're a passionate yoga guy,
yeah. Meditation. Like, you seem so happy. You've got your lovely daughter. You've got your wife in Thailand. How have you transformed your life?
It took a long time. I mean, it took a long time. The yoga was the crack. That's what cracked it for me.
What was it about yoga?
Because it's like a club. It's hot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a room. It's heavy. It's too much. It's like, but especially hot yoga for me. But I guess going back to the fundamental issue of it.
Yeah.
I love Bikram because it was, you know, it's like turning my body left and right, backwards and forwards, like a sponge. It's rinsing it out. And I'm sweating loads and it's really hot and it's 44 degrees. It's baking hot. And there's a mirror there and I get to see the ugly version of me.
You talk about it in your book where you say the first couple of times you couldn't. You had to walk out.
I walked out.
Because
walked
emotionally, out. What was going on?
It's emotional. So it's just too much.
But what
it's just
does
going,
it do to you emotionally?
It just brings up a lot of feelings. It just started bringing up a lot of stuff.
Right.
You know, especially with men. Backward bends for men, for example. It's a fact.
Yeah.
It's a science, guys. That men bending backwards, they just don't like it. I'd always find bending backwards would cause me to cry. Because you're opening up and you don't know what the future holds. And if you couldn't, you know, it's that idea of commitments, finding out, like, going into the unknown, right? But it's also the idea, you know, there's some great yogis that I've worked with, but it's the simplest postures, baby pose, I can't do. Because I have to be into a ball, right? But this is because of the trauma in the fetus.
Yeah. So it's triggering as a baby.
Being in my mother's belly for 9 months while she drank and got beat up and kicked around and hearing, it traumatises me. I can't roll into a ball.
Mm.
I can't.
So, still, isn't that incredible? The power of your head on your body.
Yeah, well, that's the power of the head on the body. But also, that's why mother, if you have the time to listen to mother, that first 5 minutes and 6 minutes is about gas, air and water, which is the universe. But then when you start to hear water, the sound of water is when you're conceived within the womb and that water becomes your holding space. You're held in water.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And there's another 5 or 6 minutes where you start to hear water and then you'll hear it's ignition and you start to hear flames and gas circulating, which is the idea of composition of your own body being made up and growth, like a fingernails begin to appear, the fetus eyes begin. For me, as a conceptual piece, is beyond me, but it's what's come from all of the traumatic experience. It's like the idea of experiencing the trauma, understanding where it comes from, is how I survived it, was by looking at these things and latching on to, I'm not broken, I'm just fixing myself because I kind of needed to go through this and you start to find these things.
So it's the idea of knowing that you can be fixed.
Yeah, it's knowing that you have the power to do it. You have the power to be able to fix yourself because no one else is going to do it for you.
Mm.
Like, I choose the wrong birds. You know, it's the same, people got the same shit as me. I've got to deal with their baggage and fucking mine. Just get out. You got to break it. I think the Hoffman process was another massive change.
Can you tell us about that, please? Yeah.
Yeah, the Hoffman process was really the next big change because the Hoffman, you know, I became an ambassador along with Thandi Newton, actually, who I didn't know for a long time was.
Well, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, Thandi's been an ambassador for them for a long time.
And Patrick Cox, who's on this podcast this week, he quotes that as the one thing to have saved him.
Yeah, well, you know, that's crazy. I mean, that's what I think, you know, and I think that, look, we all get this, given this, we're made up of these things that are inside a box. What the Hoffman does, he takes everything outside the box and then goes, yeah, these are the things that are inside the box. But then he dismantles the box and says, how was the box made?
But how does it do that, Goldie? Like, it's not that long that you're in there, is it? Something like 10
days.
No,
it's not. No, it's not. But I can't tell you because his mum's a word.
Oh, it's a secret.
Interesting. But it's not. People kind of made it like very cultish. Like, as soon as I got out of there, I was like, right, I'm getting divorced. That's it. Great. I married my mum.
So you had clarity.
Complete clarity. I realised this wasn't right and I'd married my mother and I married someone that was never going to love me in the way that I wanted to be loved, ultimately.
Or that you needed to be loved.
Yeah, because you always find this idea of needing to be loved.
Mm.
And then you, I think the Hoffman's very important because it challenges these things that you would not dare challenge. And you write a set of exercises and you come and do all of this stuff. And there's a lot of physicality that happens in there, which is pretty intense, you know, of the screaming and the beating and the, you know, of objects. You know, the modern times take modern things. And the Hoffman kind of rode that wave of understanding that society's changing. It's vibrating differently.
Right, okay. Why did it work for you?
I think it worked for me in a way that I understood the empathy of my mother and father.
Right.
I understood that my mother was 12 and she was getting beaten by her dad and she became an alcoholic because of her dad beating her. And she ran away from home. And every time she came back, he beat her more. So she ran away to be a pub singer. So she was a kid at one point. So I forgot that. You know, I always blamed my mother for putting me into care. Yeah. I always blamed her for doing that. Deep down, she went, it's my first son. I need to get him as far away from me as possible. Listen, it's not just one thing that's going to make us, because all of the stuff that gave us our trauma in life wasn't just one thing. It wasn't just one, somebody give, so, you know, somebody fucking did that to you just once.
No, they it's a system.
They repeatedly abused you. They repeatedly put you there. They did all of these different things. I was really angry with males. Anyone that was in power, system. I was always angry because, you know, you're sucking dick in a fucking Wendy house with his, but I can't see their faces. So you can't blame anyone. So you blame all older males that have authority. This person's responsible for me and they're fucking abusing me. Yeah. So I had a real, I had a hard time with the system. Anyone that will tell you that fucking police and fucking anyone who's in a uniform, I'd have a really difficult time with. Homophobic for years.
Right.
Really badly because, and all my fucking mates are gay. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, I shared a room at the Hoffman with a guy that was gay. And I was like, I've got to change my room. I can't stay in here. I had the best time. So we were like two naughty schoolboys that had to be told, you guys, you've got to be quiet, man. Because we were laughed. I got to know this person in another way. Because they knew when you know, I filled out these forms of what my fears were. And I had to be really honest. And because of all the abuse, and it's like, well, this isn't this guy. This isn't his story. This is me, again, with my narrative. My narrative. Change the fucking narrative, man. Well, you know, so the idea of changing the narrative, and especially Gabor Mate's idea of changing narrative, which is for me the idea that you've got to look at these other stories. This isn't just about you. And if you can unravel a bit of that, you can have this empathy to understand that your thing has just been something you wasn't even allowed to process yet. That's all. Yeah. Yeah. And so the idea of allowing myself to just turn up, just go and just be in yoga and turn up. And then I started to cry a lot and see the ugly me, and these layers started falling away. And also being occupied by this set of 26 moves, 26 postures twice, just to put me through the paces, to have this regimented thing, because the regiment was good for me because I was always against any type of regime.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
So, yeah, because you grew up in a system of rules.
But it's very important that we step back. There's one quote, and the quote is, I've made so many mistakes in my life that have brought me here. Thinking about making a few more, you know. So the other idea is that, you know, if these things that you think might be, you know, not good for us, all of a sudden, you know, they these moves that we listen to our heart and we go and do these other things that are different, like the Hoffman, or we need to change the narrative and do something different with ourselves. And the mistakes that were made earlier on just led me to this place. So it's about us getting out of survival mode also. Yeah. I'm a good survivor.
Oh, my God.
Also, I could survive, but I don't want to be a survivor anymore.
No, you want to be a thriver. You want to do,
I want to be a thriver, not a survivor.
Hey, Goldie, so last question we always ask is, you know, you are making changes all the time and constantly working on yourself, but is there a change that you'd still like to see within how you live your life moving forwards?
You know,
and if not with you, with the world around you?
I think it's good to get yourself off social media for a little while. It's good to be able to switch off. I think, like, try and treat it with that aspect of, can you, though? Mm. That's the question I ask people. Can you put your phone down for a week? Because I can.
Will you keep DJing, Goldie? How are you feeling about that, about being out there on the road? Do you think you'll keep doing it?
I don't know.
I thought I'd stop when I was 40, and I'm still going. I always wonder when...
I always say to Scotty, I'm going to stop. And I just did these six in America, these six gigs, and the summer was insane.
Right.
I just think maybe another year. But this
I'll be talking to you in 10 years, you'll be saying
No, but these six were fucking good, man. I mean, I shouldn't do it, but I played in Houston and I was booked for 90 minutes. I played for 4 hours. I mean...
There's your sign.
What does it say? Well, there's my sign, isn't it? I don't know. It's just, there's so much great music and there's so much amazing D&B here at the moment. It really is. I don't get sick of it in that sense. I love the label. I love the music. I love the fact that I can go back. I can be a time traveller.
Yeah.
And go back and forth in time with a set. Yeah. I've never mixed music at home. I swear on my daughter's life. I never mixed music at home saying, this is a set I'm going to play out tonight.
Yeah.
I know what the first three tunes are and that's it. And the rest, I'm just going to do that.
Goldie, thank you. Thank you so much for this. It's been epic. It's been fascinating. I really appreciate your time and your wisdom and your story. Thank you. I'm never going to let you go. No way, no how. I'm never going to let you go. No way, no how. Let us know what you thought of Goldie. If you want to read his memoirs, there are two out there, both excellent, I have to say. One from 2003 called Nine Lives Goldie, and the latest from 2017 is called All Things Remembered. It's really clever because it kind of, the book is structured in the same way that Goldie's thoughts are, in that it's quite vignette-y stylistically. So there's just different chapters about different periods in his life, but it's not chronological like a typical memoir, and it makes for a really dynamic read. Go and check that out if you fancy. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And also, obviously, like, it's been such a joy revisiting Goldie's music for this episode, but go and check his music. He's still making phenomenal music. If you listen to my last show on Radio 1, you will have heard me play the track I Adore You, which is a really good example of just, you know, how amazing the music is that he's still making. Goldie mentions some pretty heavy topics here. Remember, if you have been affected by anything raised, there is always someone to speak to if you need. You can reach the Samaritans on 116 123, and we'll put helplines in the show notes as well. We mentioned Gabor Mate and Patrick Cox. Those recent episodes are available, obviously, if you want to listen back to them at any point. Please don't forget to rate, review, subscribe to Changes, tell your friends and your family too, and we will be back next Monday as always. Changes is produced by Louise Mason through DIN Productions. See you later.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.